From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and this morning, Mary Beth Maziarz and I speak with Dr. Candace Hargens. She's an award-winning psychologist and associate professor at Emory University who will explore communication, intimacy, and what makes for good sex. This is all in her new book, Good Sex, Stories, Science, and Strategies for Sexual Liberation. And then we'll speak with local author and gratitude tiger, Joel Zuckerman. He joins the show to share how to not only feel gratitude, but how to express it and create joy through the art of impactful letters. That all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life. Stay with us. You're listening to KPCW Park City.
Welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Well, the quest for good sex is a topic that's frequently discussed and always seems to be relevant. But beyond the usual metrics like frequency and orgasm, what really is good sex? How do our personal concepts of good sex develop? And what deeper elements of our psyche, society, culture, history, and relationships influence our ideas about sex? Our guest this morning, Dr. Candace Nicole Hargens, an award-winning professor at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University, offers a much broader and more nuanced way of looking at what good sex is, along with what kind of things we can do to feel more liberated and satisfied with the sex we're having. Her new book is appropriately called Good Sex, and we're so excited to have her on the program. Dr. Hargens, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Well, I'll just start by sharing I had this interview listed in my online calendar that's shared with my family, and I had to chuckle when my husband woke up this morning with a little glint in his eye upon seeing that good sex was on the roster for the day.
He was like, hey, this is a great place to add this to the calendar.
I was like, what a great world this would be if we all woke with a certainty of good sex on the day's schedule, right?
Good.
But let's start with your definition of what good sex is and why it's important.
Good sex is sex that is good to and good for everybody involved, with each person deciding for themselves what ingredients, I call them sexual seasonings, if you will, make that sex good to them. So for some people, it might be pleasure and intimacy. And for other people, it might be connection or communication. And often you find some common ground with your partner, but is it good to and good for everyone involved?
I don't know that I'd ever read anything about sex or intimacy that so beautifully discussed equity in the sexual relationship. Early on in the book, you recount a story about an experience in which the boy in the relationship was getting the pleasure and the girl wasn't, and how your mother rightfully pointed out that that was not cool. That's not fair. And I thought, as a young woman, that is something that nobody talks about, and it is really important. No. Let's talk about equity.
Absolutely. So that was me and my mom.
I wasn't sure if I should say it was you or not.
Oh, that's no problem. And so it's so funny because when my mom read the book, she was like, you remember me saying that? And I was like, yes. And so she was like, I'm really enjoying this. I'm like, I bet you are.
Moms like that.
Right. But, you know, that moment stood out because you're so right. Most of the messages that we get, and especially for girls growing up, making their sexual debuts, are not about pleasure, not about equity, not about reciprocity. They're about safety, preventing yourself from being hurt, not having it all so you can be a good girl and morally upstanding. And the equity piece is a through line, because when we see each other as both inherently worthy of getting the good that life has to offer, then it means that we're meeting in the middle, and that there's not this imbalance that you see in so many other areas of life where you typically don't have as much control, that they're in that shared intimate space, some erotic equity, some intimate justice.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Dr. Candace Hargens. She's written a book called
Good Sex, Stories, Science, and Strategies for Sexual Liberation. And, you know, we're public radio, we're family friendly here, Candace, and I am picturing on people's car radios as they're, going skiing this morning or taking their kids to school, or maybe they're at the recycle center where they blast our radio station, and we're talking about good sex. And it feels a little... I was going to use the word cringy because just of the topic, but the bottom line is none of us would be here without sex, right? It's about procreation. It's about many other things. But so how do you make, I mean, you're in public health at Emory University. How do you normalize the conversation around it? And how can we tell those people in their cars listening right now, don't shut off, don't turn us off, keep listening, because this is important.
Absolutely. It's one of the most common and most normal experiences of humanity across the lifespan, right? And to your point, Lynn, all of us came into the world through sex. And so because it's so normal, I try to talk about it in a way that has some levity and clarity and reduces that stigma and taboo that most of us were raised in and kind of swam in that water of like, you should be ashamed for talking about sex, or you should feel like nervous about having these conversations. And so the way I approach it is to recognize how normal it is, recognize how common it is, and how health promoting sex can be. Like, there are so many benefits to a healthy and good sex life.
Okay. Well, also, I want our listeners to reflect on if we are parents and we somehow stumbled through trying to have the birds and bees conversation, how we may have blundered, or how we may have done well, or how our parents, like you talked about your mother, my mother was extremely open about it, and she wanted us to know everything. You know, so let's talk a little bit about how we can best talk to our kids about sex.
Absolutely. In a comprehensive, medically accurate, developmentally appropriate way. So I have a one-year-old and a six-year-old. At one, that conversation is, I'm changing the diaper. He's finding his genitals. I'm like, hey, you noticed that. And then at six, it's like, good touch, bad touch. Who has access to your body? What is consent? When you want to play and somebody doesn't want to play, then you don't play. You know, like those conversations are adjacent to sex, but they are really core. And so if you build it in where you're talking about genitals with their medically appropriate name, where you're talking about consent early on, as your child starts to explore their body or be curious about what it might mean to be partnered, you have laid a landscape of having these conversations so they're not afraid to come to you. And it's okay to do it awkward. It's okay to feel nervous about it or feel awkward about it if most of us didn't get really good sex ed. And so we're, you know, figuring it out, but being courageous enough to figure it out together. And so I always encourage people to choose courage in these conversations. You can even acknowledge, hey, I feel a little bit awkward. Maybe you do too, but you're worth it to me to have a good conversation about this.
That makes so much sense. There are a lot of things in this book that I've never seen addressed in books about sex. So I so appreciate you bringing these to the public consciousness. There was a lot about worthiness and a lot about what creates our sexual recipe for desire, what turns us on, and how really there are a lot of stereotypical elements of culture and society and privilege and things that no one's discussing about what we think should look like perfect sex, what the movies tell us should be perfect sex. And how can we navigate this? How can we know ourselves and acknowledge ourselves and our little idiosyncrasies and our personal histories in a way to find that worthiness and prepare ourselves for better sex?
I mean, I know the world does a number on us and our sense of worthiness because of capitalism, right? It's like the world wants to sell us stuff. And so in order to do that, it has to make you feel less than. That means your body has to feel less than. Your desires have to feel less than. There's always this sell. And unfortunately, what I've learned through my research over the course of 15 years is that family systems often don't do as much as they possibly could to reinforce that inherent worthiness. And so you get adults people in their 20s, 30s, 40s who are still trying to remember or figure out that they're inherently worthy, and that shows up in their intimate lives. And to practice recognizing yourself and your partner as inherently worthy is like a life journey after that, once you figure out, oh, because the messages are so constant. And that takes into account how you ask for the things you want, whether you feel like you can ask for the things you want, how you say no to something that you don't want. And if you can't say no, you can never fully say yes. And so being aware of your desires, knowing that because you're in, or here's one example that I often use. So we get this idea, this really unseasoned sexual script about who is worthy of good sex. And that person's body is usually abled and slim, right? In our movies, you see a slim body. In our movies, you see an able body. And so people who have differently abled bodies or people who have any number of like different types of bodies other than the stereotypical ideal often struggle with this. Am I worthy of sex? The answer is yes. The answer is you are worthy to be cared for and have intimacy and have love and passion and all of the goods that life has to offer.
Yeah, it's so true. Things like the body positivity movement, and there are elements that are trying to be more inclusive. And the things that I find so fascinating, though, is that years ago I read a survey that said something like 70% of men prefer a rounder, curvier woman. And yet what we're seeing in the media is a very different kind of shaped woman. And I'm really glad to see that's changing to reflect how actual women look and feel their best. There was a great survey that you highlight in the book, the Big Sex Study, where you asked over 400 people with diverse ethnicities, ages, sexual, gender identities, socioeconomic backgrounds to what makes for good sex for them. And I'm just going to read this list because it's fascinating. Distilling them down to the top 20 list was good sex is passionate, intimate, fun, pleasurable, satisfying, reciprocal, connected, consensual, orgasmic, nasty, kinky, exciting, liberating, loving, spiritual, sensual, communicative, wet, safe, relaxing, and comfortable. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of stuff. That is so diverse. As I read that, I was like, I could pick this and pick that and pick that. And
that's the point, right? Yes. You want to pick the things that resonate for you. And so that list that we distilled it down to doesn't mean that it has to be all of those things every single time. I asked them, what's the three top three for you? And my top three can evolve depending on like what season of life I'm in. There's one word that always sticks with me, but the other words can come and go. If I'm just finishing, you know, nursing a person for 12 months, it might be something totally different than what it is when I'm in my 30s and child free, you know? So like those things are okay. But I love having a comprehensive list, and each chapter is one thing off the list.
Yeah, I love how you do that. I was reading down the chapter headings as Mary Beth was going over that list, and it's all here. And you know, the one that kind of pops out for me is good sex is communicative. And it makes me wonder about if at different stages of our life, we tend to talk more, have better communication about it, and then worse communication. Like, are there certain decades in which we do one or the other? What do you find?
Oh, that's a good question, because I don't know. I think for some of us, it is based on the decade, but the thing that correlates with the decade is our own sense of self-awareness and confidence. So, you know, teen you versus 20 you versus 30, 40, 50, 60 year old you. My hope is that each year, each decade, you feel more certain, self-assured. And so your communication then comes out of that. But in the chapter on communication, I break down those three fears that people usually are navigating. Fear that you're, so self fears, relationship fears, and partner fears. And so I think those can be in place across decades, and they give you a good opportunity to say, this is where I'm going to focus. Those self fears are like, I don't want to come across as if I don't know anything. I don't want to look inadequate. The relationship fears are like, I shouldn't have to talk about this relationship. Good relationships, they don't ever have to talk about things, or I don't know if our relationship can stand if I mention this thing. And then the partner fears, and this is one I experience often with a lot of women, is that we don't want to hurt our partner's ego. We don't want to make them upset or make them feel inadequate. And so we end up tiptoeing around the things that really would make the sex good to us because we're trying to protect or preserve them in some way. And so those each are points as a therapist, as a psychologist, that I work with people on to make sure that they're having the communication that leads to the good sex.
Yeah, those are really good points. I also wanted to ask you about communication in our peer groups. I feel lucky to have always, no matter what decade of my life I'm in, I'm surrounded by wonderful women with whom I can have really detailed conversations about sex, and we do. And I wonder sometimes about, you know, men, our counterparts in the male category, who maybe don't have that, or do they?
You know, unfortunately, I feel like they're not having as robust conversations because sometimes, depending on the friend group, they're trying to one-up each other as opposed to really understand and help each other. And so if you're building your identity, your masculinity on the grounds of your sexual prowess, then the conversations you can have kind of get caught up in that. But if you have a more comprehensive masculinity where you're thinking about yourself as a whole person and your friend group represents that, I think men can have some really good conversations with each other, really help each other out. My first research projects were focusing on men and sexuality, and I was hosting focus groups with men, and many of them were like, this is the first time I'm having a thoughtful conversation with my peers related to sex.
Yeah, I'm glad, Lynn, that you have a good cohort group to talk about, honestly, because sometimes in my life I haven't had that. And it's really weird the way women even will try to save face with each other. If somebody in the group seems to have a really hot sex life, you don't want to admit that you might be in a dry spell or something. Or the opposite, if everyone's complaining, you don't want to be bragging. So it's interesting. One of the things that's interesting about this book, Good Sex, is that not only do you explore the backgrounds about what makes us the way we are about sex, but you also do give some solid strategies. One of the things that stuck out for me was the yes, no, maybe list. Could you share a little bit about that?
This is one of my easiest and most favorite sex education strategies. And so you have a list, you can use your phone, you can use paper. If you're like me and you like to write things down, you put a yes column, a no column, and a maybe so column. And your yes column is all the things that you've already tried that you know you love and you want to get returned to, or the things you've never tried, but you know if you get the opportunity, it's on. Your no list is you've tried it, never want to go back. Or you've never tried it, you don't even need to try it. You just know it's a no thank you for you. And then your maybe so is like, it depends on the context. Like, am I in the Caribbean? You know, like, is it, am I in Italy? And like, you know, it's more contextual, but it depends on the type of partner you're with, location, and things like that. So writing that for yourself is really important. Before you ever share it with anyone, you becoming more sexually self-aware is really a cornerstone to this work. And then if you are partnered, you can share it. If you are not partnered and you're enjoying good solo sex, it's a great place for you to think through what you want your sex life to be.
When you talk about sexual seasonings, so there are sexual ingredients and sexual seasonings, which I think is a terrific metaphor, because you can always, you can have a chicken and a potato, and there are a lot of ways that chicken and potato can come out of the other side of it.
That's right.
So I grew up Catholic. I'm the oldest daughter. I'm big family.
Oh, me too.
I've got baggage from here to Oklahoma. So trying to come out of that, part of that is recognizing and acknowledging maybe some of those things. But I'm also wondering, like, do our sexual seasonings change as we age? It feels like they're changing.
Oh, yeah, they are. And I just want to touch and agree on the eldest daughter and all of the stuff that comes with. I am journeying with in this. And I share that in the book because I'm like, hey, y'all, I'm not the final boss in good sex just because I wrote this book. Like, I am still on the journey. But yes, they change. So in this perimenopausal state of life, then that means that I have to think more conscientiously about moisturizers and like in a different stage of life, it was about passion, and I had the energy and capacity for that that I might not have at this stage. So yes, the sexual seasonings evolve with you, as they should, because you're becoming more of yourself and learning new things. And so if I liked French fries when I was 20, I liked seasoned salt. And now that I'm 42, I like truffle salt. Like, you know, those are my seasonings have changed a bit.
So great. Okay, I just have to ask you, Candace, are people having great sex in their 80s? Are they having great sex in their 90s? Tell us, do tell.
Absolutely. And one of the things I love most about speaking with people across the lifespan is that their definition of sex becomes more expansive. So maybe things reproductively are not working. Your genitals might not work in the same way. But then what can sex be when you take having to be a certain way off the table, having to have certain acts off the table? You can be more expansive, more thoughtful, more affectionate, more attentive, more nuanced. You can spend more time, especially if you're not spending the bulk of your time working and laboring for a specific company. Like there's so much that I learn from people who have more years that I love to weave in and invite people who are younger to think about.
That's so wonderful to hear. I also want to bring up the topic of, you know, sex education. More of it is being taken out of our schools, and a lot more than is now being left to parents to teach their kids about. And I think a lot of parents don't teach their kids about. And so I'm just wondering how we are navigating through this. You as a public health expert must know a lot more about what's going on in the world and how can we educate our young people.
We know that abstinence-only sex education does not produce good health promoting outcomes. Comprehensive sex ed, where it's medically accurate, where it is nuanced, where it's not just somebody showing a pic of diseased genitals, like it really makes a big difference, and it can happen in multifaceted ways. So if your school system isn't offering comprehensive sex ed, that's a great place for advocacy. Advocating on the local level is going to make a big difference right now. But I also think about training parents and peers. So parents, for sure, there's a great Instagram called Sex Positive Families. They have beautiful resources for how to talk about sex at different ages. But then peers are who your kids are going to talk to. That's who they're going to go to first. That's who they're spending a lot of time with. And you want to make sure that your kid is one of the kids that peers can go to and have medically accurate information. And so there's so many good social media accounts. I know we kind of disparage social media, but there are really great sex educators that focus on youth and providing them with affirming, life-affirming, identity-affirming, comprehensive sex ed, because they know kids are going to talk to each other, and that's who we want to be able to share good quality information to.
There is so much interesting content in this book. We've only touched on the surface, but are there a couple guiding principles that you'd love to share with our listeners as they move forward?
Yes. When I think about sexual liberation, which is like the foundation of the entire book, I think about it not in the way that a lot of people have come to understand sex positivity and sexual liberation. It's like you're just doing all the things with no regard for yourself or for anyone else. It gets a bad rap, but it really is you being curious about your sexual self, the things that you learned, your sexual recipes, and maybe you deciding to move in more value congruent ways. That's liberation. So not you upholding just another set of scripts about what sex should be from really, you know, narrow scripts. Just being who you are sexually, coming into some authenticity around that, being able to explore and not feeling like you're less of a moral person or less of a good person if you do.
I'm going to quote one thing that you mentioned. The 1680s definition of orgasm was the acme of venereal excitement. There is a phrase that I think really sums up our puritanical roots.
It is.
Hopefully we are coming far, far away from that.
I don't think we are.
Well, Dr. Hargaud, this has been such an interesting conversation. I wish we could talk for another hour. The book is Good Sex, Dr. Nicole Hargons, thank you so much for being part of the program of The Mountain Life today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Take good care. Bye-bye.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Well, the concept of gratitude as a social movement has become ubiquitous in recent decades. And if you believe one of the key elements of living a grateful life is to express gratitude, as opposed to just feeling it or being aware of your blessings, then let my next guest, Joel Zuckerman, guide you towards fierce gratitude. Joel is the author of 10 books, 8 of them on the subject of golf, 2 of them on gratitude. He joins me now in the studio to talk about his new book, Gratitude Tiger. Joel Zuckerman, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you, Lynn. Pleasure to be with you again. I appreciate you. I'm grateful that you have me on once a year or so.
Yeah. Well, it's always a fun conversation, no matter what we talk about. But it was a handful of years ago that you wrote your 9th book, but this one was the first one on gratitude, on the topic of gratitude. What was this light that went on, this epiphany for you about gratitude?
What happened was the reason I pivoted away from golf writing, which was fun and lucrative and exciting for 20 years, I wrote a letter in 2013. I read about the concept of writing letters of gratitude in a famous self-help book everyone's heard of, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, and It's All Small Stuff. And one of the chapters was write a heartfelt letter. So at that time in 2013, 11 years ago, I said, I can write a letter of gratitude, a heartfelt letter. I'm a professional writer. I write books and magazine articles and internet articles. Sat down to write a letter to a business associate, a friend of mine, someone who I consider a mentor. As I sat down to write it, it never occurred to me I would write a second letter. But when I put that letter in the mail to my friend Dan Shepherd, who lives in Virginia, I was taken aback by the warmth and the feeling of accomplishment and just that intense personal connection that I had outlined in the letter, thanking him for the help that he had provided me in my long golf writing career. So a week later, I wrote another. Then I wrote another. And after a year, it was 20. And then I remember when I wrote my 50th letter, 2 years in, I put a little pinch of confetti into the envelope. Then it was 100, writing about 20, 25 letters a year. And then when I wrote my 150th letter, I had an epiphany. I said, I'm going to write a book called Grateful. And I'm going to write 30 more letters, 180 letters. And I'm going to give the book away to everyone, not everyone, but many of the people I had written letters to. Kind of a commemorative piece about our relationship and my relationship with all of these people. And part of me thought I'd be done writing letters then, but then I wrote another and another. And now I'm up to 275 letters, or almost 100 since Grateful came out. And a couple years ago, I said, this is commercial knowledge. People should know about this. That's when I decided to write Gratitude Tiger.
Okay. Joel, do you consider yourself a Utahn at this point? Have you lived here long enough that you call yourself a Utahn?
I would not be so presumptuous, or as they say, I wasn't born in Utah, but I got here as quick as I could.
That's good.
I've been here off and on for 26 years, most of the time for the last 12 and full time for coming up on 8. Okay. So the answer is no.
Okay. Well, it took me about 30 years of living here before I finally called myself a Utahn, like claiming it. Well, you know, in Utah, we have this funny little saying, preciate ya.
Appreciate ya?
Yeah.
I've never heard that.
So you don't run in the right circles then, I guess.
that goes without saying.
So there's appreciate ya, you know, that you can say to everyone, you know, what does that really mean? And then there's going into gratitude so deeply that you are compelled to write a letter. And I think that as people are listening to this conversation, they might say, Well, gratitude, it's kind of simple. How do you very authentically arrive at why you feel gratitude, and what are the you know, different layers of feeling gratitude? What is gratitude really?
It's such a great question. The key element of our conversation will happen in the next 30 seconds. The main reason that I've written 270 letters of gratitude is because it makes me feel good. The letter that someone receives, and there are dozens and dozens of people in this town who have gotten letters from me, their delight or joy or satisfaction is collateral. The reason I write is to make myself feel good. The main chapter in Gratitude Tiger is called The Seven Pillars of Expressive Gratitude, and that is the title of my keynote speech. And the number one pillar is writing letters of gratitude makes you, the letter writer, feel good. So you can think about gratitude and you can feel gratitude and you can say, appreciate ya. But until you take a moment or a half hour or however long it takes you to compose your thoughts and let someone in your orbit, whether they're close, whether they're present, whether they're from your past, know that you are grateful to know them or have known them in the past, it has tremendous benefits to you, the letter writer. That's the key.
That is the key. And yet, gratitude is not a selfish act.
It is for me.
Okay, so it's all about me, this gratitude that I'm showing you.
I'm telling you, I can't emphasize it enough, because what you said is a typical, for lack of a better term, skeptical response. Why would I write someone? Now, they know I care about them. We talk all the time, blah, blah, whatever it is. Or my college professor, yeah, he helped me, but that was 30 years ago. Why do I write the letters, or why should everyone write letters? Because it will make you feel good. And the person who receives it, needless to say, will be delighted and thrilled and taken aback to receive a letter saying, I'm grateful for your presence in my life, but the reason to do it is to make yourself feel good. The back cover of my new book says personal growth. It's in the personal growth category. That's a new one, believe me.
So gratitude, is it more important, you think, your new book, Gratitude Tiger, for someone who typically has difficulty feeling gratitude, or is it for those of us who do appreciate the people around us and feel gratitude and feel blessed and all that, and it's just taking the one step further into letter writing? I mean, it feels to me like if we are talking about self-growth, it's for that person who has a hard time feeling gratitude.
It is for all people. So there's a chapter in the book, I forget the name of the chapter, but there's a lot of exercises in the book to unscrew your gratitude spigot. Many of us in this town and mountain towns everywhere, that spigot is pretty loose and it flows freely. Other people, their gratitude spigot is shut tight. It's rusted tight. They can't feel gratitude easily. So there's a series of exercises in the book to help you lubricate your spigot and allow you to show gratitude. If you don't show any gratitude, to show you a little. If you show a little, to show more. If you show quite a bit, to show even more than that. And I want to make a very important point about these letters. I'm a professional writer, 10 books, 1,000 magazine stories. The words come easily for me. And for most people, it's not going to be as easy, just like it's easy for me to talk to you on the radio. You're not getting 10-word answers from me. Okay, there's a chapter in my book called Seven Paragraphs, Seven Sentences, Seven Words. What does that mean? It means I write letters that are seven paragraphs long, give or take. I'm not counting every one. The point being, they're kind of free association, stream of consciousness letters where I espouse gratitude to the person I'm writing and talk about things on my mind or talk about things in our past. But you can show deep gratitude in seven sentences and even, Lynn, in seven words. For those who are taciturn, who are a little more closed off, or who don't have the time. If you're in a business setting and you want to show your employees gratitude, you can do it in just 7 words.
Yeah, and you give some of those examples. I love how you break it into, in your book, you know, these 7 words that you might say to a loved one, these 7 words that you might say to a work colleague. And I think we do hear a lot of those 7-word utterances.
Better to put them in an email. Now, all my letters are typewritten or word processed, stamp, envelope, occasionally one out of 20 or 50 I'll hand to someone or leave for them, but they're put in the mail. I think in the work environment, Slack, interoffice communication, email, or text are fine, and you can do it in 7 words. Can I give you a couple of examples?
Yeah.
In the work, and then I'll tell you a really funny, true story when I spoke on this subject, gratitude in the workplace. So here's a couple of examples of what you can say to an employee. You are the cog in the machine. That's it. You are the best hire we've made. This department wouldn't run without you. Simple, powerful, pointed moments of gratitude that your employee or your colleague is going to feel like, wow, this person really sees me. They value me here at the workplace, which can help, obviously, with employee morale and employee retention. No one has any problem with employee retention. People have a problem with employee defection.
Yeah, no kidding. If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I am joined by Joel Zuckerman. He is a local author, and he has written a new book that we're talking about today. It's called Gratitude Tiger, Creating Joy Through the Art of Impactful Letters. He's also a speaker, and he conducts workshops now on gratitude. And Joel, okay, so going back to me writing a letter of gratitude is about me. It's because I do it because it makes me feel good. I once had a boss who could never tell you anything positive about the job you were doing, the job I was doing. There was just something that blocked this person from ever expressing gratitude, ever saying anything but what you were doing wrong. And it just strikes me as you're talking here about how that person might, wow, it might really help them to learn how to express gratitude. What do you think holds someone back from that? Thinking that if you give a little positivity that people won't keep trying hard? I don't know.
And in this long career I've had, my first book came out 22-23 years ago. The trials and tribulations, the ups and downs of people who pay attention, don't pay attention, can't be bothered. I'm not talking about strangers. I had a built-in audience of golf fanatics all over the world and beyond. I'm talking about the hundreds of people in my own orbit. Didn't really care. Now I'm in the gratitude space. Most people don't really care. I think the short answer is most of us, all of us, are flawed, have problems. Your boss sounds like a difficult person. There's a chapter in the new book where I quote, I talk about the movie Horrible Bosses. Horrible Bosses was a movie from 15 years ago with, Jamie Foxx and a bunch of big stars. And it did...
Disturbing movie, actually.
I never saw it. I write about it in the book, but the point is it did big business in the box office because, needless to say, the general public could really relate. Mm-hmm. Horrible Bosses. So your boss that you're talking about sounds like a very difficult person. His gratitude spigot, or her gratitude spigot, shut tight. But it feels good to give gratitude, to express yourself. I'll give you an example. I've done this many, many times. If a restaurant meal is good or a good experience, whatever, I will seek out the manager or I'll send an email and say, I want you to know I really enjoyed what we did last night. And most managers or owners are taken aback. They only hear from people when there's a complaint. If things are fine, people walk out, without a word. It's so easy for the street, it's so easy for it to be a two-way street.
Yeah.
And it takes so little effort to say, hey, that dessert was great. Oh my God, those beers you have here, they're so cold. It takes no effort, but yet most people cannot, is it be bothered or they don't think about it? But showing gratitude, even for something as crisp French fries to the server. Man, these are good. Can you tell the chef that he put them in the fryer later or whatever? It's easy to show gratitude. And letter writing is just, in my opinion, the ultimate manifestation of feeling gratitude to help yourself.
Yes. I was recently on a trip with a girlfriend and we were, you know, eating out in restaurants and we would say, I mean, if the food was great, if the service was great, we would make a point to just say, this was so wonderful. I loved the baked fennel or whatever it was. And inevitably they would say, oh, thank you so much. Could you put that in a review? And in this day and age when business owners live and die by reviews, I just thought, well, that's funny. That's showing, it is sort of writing a letter of gratitude if you're writing a review, and it's really helpful for that person.
And they're also asking you to do something beyond what you had intended, maybe not beyond what you would do, but beyond what you had intended. And let me add one more thing to this same subject. You don't want to be negative Nelly, right? So most people, 95%, are going to only say something when they have a problem or a complaint or a question or a suggestion. Try balancing the scales, because I'm the same person. I was a critic. When I wrote all those golf books, I was writing criticism of golf courses, resorts, spas, restaurants. So if you are always going to find something that could be improved with whatever it is, the restaurant, the hotel, the spa, wherever you are, it's nice to balance it when something is really good by saying, you know what? I thought those appetizers, those steamed mussels were some of the best I've had. Now, as for the pasta, it felt a little al dente. So, you know, you try and yin and yang. You try and show some love because inevitably not everything's going to be 100% great.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, and, you know, speaking of a restaurant, you could also say, and I've seen this happen before, where someone has a really bad experience at, say, a restaurant or an Airbnb or something, and they end up saying, we had these issues, and the way that it was dealt with by the owner, by the host, by the waiter, was so impressive. And so it's finding gratitude even when something didn't go right, because that's what it's about, right? It's about how things are resolved. Or
you have to provide constructive criticism. I have friends, if they don't like a restaurant, they walk out, they don't say a word, they badmouth it to everyone they know. How about, as an alternative, you bring over the manager or the owner and say, listen, I think you should consider some of these suggestions, because you want, at the end of the day, people to succeed.
Yes.
You want there to be a good, this town needs good restaurants, where I used to live in Georgia, needed good restaurants. You don't want people to fail. You don't want to just walk out and say, okay, thanks for everything, and then say, oh my God, don't go to Joe's Diner.
Yeah.
Give Joe a chance. Tell him what could be better, and maybe things will improve.
Yeah, and that is, and you know, it's really an indirect expression of gratitude. It really is. So there are these layers of gratitude and so many different layers that you talk about in the book. What do you think is really, for you, what really encapsulates gratitude when you write a letter? Like, why do you think writing a letter is so important rather than just expressing it verbally?
I'll answer that in one word, which, you know, I never do. Ceremonial.
Ah, I like that.
I've written 270 letters. I imagine some have been thrown away. I know some have been framed. And I like to think that hundreds have been kept in a drawer, maybe never to be seen again. But a letter of gratitude, at least in my own mind, is not like a Christmas card or a birthday card where you think, okay, how long do I have to keep this on the mantle? Most people have a 2-day, 4-day shelf life for that type of thing. A letter of gratitude, receiving something in the mail, is ceremonial. It shows you've taken the time and effort to reach out to someone in a way that a text, an emoji, a GIF, an email do not do. Now, I'm old school. I wrote this book, Lynn, to bolster my professional speaking. I wrote this book to provide gravitas and a certain degree of credibility in a world that I'm inhabiting of nonprofits and corporate groups. I'm speaking at high-end wellness resorts. And as you can imagine, most of the people who hear me speak are 40 years old or older. Hard to get a 20-year-old to even write an email. They prefer to text.
Yeah.
But I am talking old school, where you handwrite, or in my case, word process. I don't want to say typewrite, really show you my age. But my letters are printed for efficiency's sake, so no one has to deal with my objectionable handwriting. It also gives me this archive, this incredibly deep archive of letters to who I've written to, when, and what I've said.
Yeah.
And the art of writing the letter is good for you, the writer. Mm-hmm. And needless to say, the person who receives a letter of gratitude out of the blue, it's not their birthday, it's not Christmas, and someone is expressing deep gratitude or shallow gratitude for their relationship, they're singing your praises, or maybe they're just humming your praises, depending on the relationship. They, of course, are blown away. But to reiterate what I said earlier, I write the letters because it makes me feel good. That is pillar number one of the seven pillars.
And we all want to feel good. Okay, so when you were talking a bit ago, you said something about a professor writing a letter of gratitude to an old professor. And it immediately took me to Steven Sternfeld, my professor of Italian that I had probably 30 years ago. He so turned me on to learning Italian. I'm still like a fanatic about learning Italian. And it was thanks to him. And
You got to write him a letter.
You're right. I just thought I got to write Steve Sternfeld a letter. But there is this thing. Do you ever preface your letters by saying, because it would be sort of strange at this point, 30 years later, for me to send, you're like, does he even remember who I am? Does it matter? Do I preface it by saying, I'm undergoing this sort of practice where I want to write letters of gratitude and you popped into my mind? Or do you just say, wow, what a difference you made in my life?
Such a great question. One of the chapters in the new book is called 10 Concepts to Jumpstart Letters for people that the words just don't flow freely. One of the first concepts is reference the surprise of the letter. Dear Professor Sternfeld, first of all, this letter is going to come as a complete shock to you. Second of all, there's an excellent chance you have no freaking idea who I am. Let me remind you, I took your class in Italian at Harvard back in...
or University of Utah.
Whatever. My name is Lynn. I don't know what your old name was. I don't know if you remember me, but I want you to know that you ignited my passion. Blah, 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 blah. This guy, it'll be the highlight of his day, if not his week. But his appreciation is collateral joy. You're writing the letter for yourself.
Yeah.
It's an amazing hobby. I could never envision myself to not do this.
Right.
As long as people continue to inspire, befriend me.
Yeah.
And show me a kindness. I will. Now, there are hundreds of people I know that I've never written to and likely never will. But my orbit is wide enough that people inspire me and I want to share my gratitude with them. And it's absolutely addictive. That's the gist of Gratitude Tiger.
Yeah, I love it. Well, it's very obvious then why you won't get the benefit if you use ChatGPT to write your gratitude letter for you, because it's not coming from you.
Let me interject. There's a chapter in the book called AI, where I say, you know what? If you're going to use ChatGPT, go buy a Hallmark card like your Aunt Edna got you every Christmas with a $5 bill. Write the letter. It can be seven words. It can be three sentences, but write it yourself. Otherwise, it's like riding a bike with training wheels. You're riding, but not really. You have to do it yourself.
The book is Gratitude Tiger. My guest is Joel Zuckerman. And Joel, can you just leave us with a way to get to our most sincere feeling of gratitude to be able to write the letter? We all sit down and write a letter of thank you, and we always say, oh gosh, okay, what am I really thankful for? How do I get to that? It's about sincerity and it's about creativity.
It is, and the difference between a letter of gratitude and a thank you note is a thank you note is a specific thank you for dinner, mm-hmm. thank you for the gift, thank you for introducing me to Bill. A letter of gratitude, A, comes as a surprise, and B, it's a general feeling of gratitude. You can start a letter of gratitude saying, hey, thanks for having us for dinner last night or last week. It was really delicious. But this isn't just a thank you note, Lynn. I want to tell you that I'm grateful for our friendship for the last 15 years, way beyond dinner last week. And you expound from there. And let me, before we go, I've got book signings all weekend. Just wanted to throw out a couple of names. I'll be at the St. Regis. I'll be at Dolly's. I'll be at the Steo Boutique on Main Street. And I will be at Barnes & Noble meeting people, signing books this week. Check out today's Park Record. And it has the schedule of where I'll be and when I'll be there.
That's great. Always so fun to talk to you, Joel, and those people who visit you at any number of these places. Wow, you're on fire, you gratitude tiger. Anyone who meets Joel will have a wonderful time speaking with him, with you.
Aren't you sweet?
Thank you, Joel.
I'm so grateful to you.
Grateful for you, too. Maybe I'll write you a letter.
Don't bother.
Okay.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab or on the KPCW app or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW The Mountain Life. And if you like today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.